Welcome to the Talk BD podcast, where we break down the science and strategies to live well with bipolar disorder.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to another session in our series of Crest BD Talk BD events. I'm Dr. Emma Morton, and I'd like to thank you all for joining our conversation, whether you are streaming on YouTube or catching up with the podcast. I'm speaking to you from Vancouver, British Columbia, the traditional, ancestral, and unceded territory of the Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh Nations. Thank you for joining us today. I think there's no other way to introduce our topic today than with a salt and pepper lyric. Let's talk about sex. Although everyone varies, for many people, sex, partnered or solo, can be a very important part of expressing intimacy, feeling pleasure, stress relief, or to express or explore ourselves. But for all that sex throughout history has inspired stories, art, and music, we are still, as a culture, very squeamish when it comes to talking about it, even to the people we are having sex with. This is a challenge for people who live with a mood disorder like bipolar disorder, whose sexual drive and ability can unfortunately be impacted by mood symptoms and medication. And unfortunately, healthcare professionals often avoid asking people about sex because they're uncomfortable or embarrassed or didn't receive training in talking about these issues. So today, we wanted to spend some time talking about this important but rarely discussed issue. Before we get started, I did want to mention briefly that today's topic can be sensitive and may bring up some difficult memories. If that happens, please be kind to yourself, take a pause if the discussion is too heavy, and reach out to one of the support options listed on our Talk BD webpage. Our guests are going to focus discussion on how to work towards positive expressions of sexuality, but it's important for us to acknowledge that there are some foundational components of positive sexuality, one of which is consent. This is a bigger topic than we have time to adequately discuss, but we wanted to emphasize how central it is that sex is wanted, that this is clearly and freely communicated, and that this communication is ongoing. We have some resources listed on what consent looks like and how to talk about it, as well as places to go if you'd like to get additional advice or support. I'd now like to welcome our guest speakers for today's session, Dr. Heather Armstrong, who once worked with Crest BD Network Lead Professor Erin Mihalik here in Vancouver. She now works as a lecturer in sexual health at the University of Southampton across the pond in England. We are also joined by Victoria Maxwell, a mental health educator and performing artist and longtime member of Crest BD. So thank you both for joining us today.
Thanks very much.
Thanks.
Before we get started with your conversation, I'll start a round of quick introductions, and I'll also ask both of you about one non-work-related thing that you've been doing with your time. Personally, I am a researcher at the University of British Columbia, working with the Crest BD team since my PhD days in Australia. My research is focused on psychological and self-management interventions to optimize quality of life for people living with bipolar disorder. And I was responsible for writing a lot of the content for the Crest BD Polaros app, including some of the strategies for healthy sexuality. In terms of hobbies, now that we finally have some sunshine in Vancouver, I have been back on the trails, exploring, hiking, and trying to see as many of the beautiful views that this land has to offer. I'll now pass the mic to Dr. Armstrong to introduce herself. So we'd love to hear more about where you work, as well as one non-work thing you enjoy in your downtime.
Sure. So as Emma said, I'm Dr. Heather Armstrong. I'm a lecturer in sexual health over in England, but I am from Vancouver originally. So I've been now in the UK for about 4.5 years. But most of my research focuses on sexual health and well-being, looking at things like sexual function, sexual motivation, and I particularly focus on sexual and gender minority individuals. Something that I quite enjoy these days is that I have a 15-year-old sausage dog, a little dachshund named Sebastian, and so him and I spend a lot of cuddle times on the couch these days watching TV and that kind of thing.
Oh, thank you so much. I'd love to see some photos. Maybe we can get a pet section of the guest introductions on the Talk BD page. Victoria, how about yourself? What have you been up to lately?
So my name's Victoria, and I am joining you from Wilkway, colonially known as Half Moon Bay on the Sunshine Coast, the unceded ancestral lands of the Coast Salish people and the traditional territories of the Tsleil-Waututh First Nations. I'm a person with lived experience, bipolar disorder, anxiety, and psychosis. I live well with it. And I'm also a keynote speaker, and I've been a member of CREST for quite a long time as well. And like you, Emma, since the weather has turned so nice here, I have started creating hanging baskets outside with flowers and things. I don't necessarily have a green thumb, but I am attempting to see how well I can keep them alive and cared for.
Fantastic. Yeah, definitely send me some progress photos. I have killed many a cactus in my time, so I can only appreciate
the work of gardeners from afar.
So I'm sure everyone is really excited to hear about what both of you have to say about today's topic. So I'll pass the microphones over to you to talk more about sex and bipolar disorder.
So I guess I can kind of kick us off. I guess one of the first things that I really wanted just to acknowledge is that sex is much more than just a behavior. So usually people are talking about the behavior, and of course, that's a really big part of it, but it's really a fundamental part of who we are as people. And so it's a major component of our overall health and our overall well-being. And it goes beyond just kind of the physical aspect, but we need to also consider kind of the emotional and the mental and the social well-being that ties in with our sexual lives. And so for people with bipolar disorder, there can be a wide variety of effects that are impacted because of the combination of our sexual selves and the bipolar disorder. And so there's three kind of primary ways or three main ways that there can be these impacts. And so the first is as a direct result of the bipolar disorder itself. So that could be experiencing things like heightened mood or periods of reduced sexual desire or less interest in sex itself. The second way is actually through sort of secondary effects of medications. And so the medications that can be used to treat bipolar disorder can also have impacts, can potentially reduce desire or reduce how the body responds to sexual stimuli. So people may find it more difficult to have an erection or to become lubricated. And something else that we might not consider is that there can be other physical changes as well. So certain medications may be associated with things like weight gain. And so that can impact how we feel about ourselves as sexual people. And that might change how we feel about ourselves sexually too. Then the third thing that I think just to acknowledge is that there could be other factors as well that are not related to bipolar disorder that are common to lots of people. And those can have impacts on our sexuality as well. And so these could be common to people, especially in people in longer term relationships. So I think acknowledging that in everybody's lives, there are going to be periods of normal ebbs and flows in terms of sexual desire and sexual behavior. And so someone may be experiencing low desire because of issues related to bipolar disorder, but it could also be something like general life stressors or problems at work or problems in the relationship as well. So there's a wide variety of different ways that people can certainly be impacted in terms of their sexuality.
Yeah, and Heather, I can relate to that. And I'm so happy that we're talking about it, because this is something that, I mean, Emma, you alluded to that in general, we don't feel comfortable talking about sexuality or sex. We haven't had practice having these sort of sensitive conversations. And I think it even more so with bipolar disorder, because sometimes we're acting in a way that's so outside of our norm, and it can be embarrassing, and we can sometimes feel ashamed, even though it's not due to us, it's the illness itself. And I can relate to a lot of what you've talked about. And I think you're going to probably get into more about sort of heightened sex drive and low sex drive and things. So I can speak to sort of more specific examples and things that I would have liked to have happened, and what I do now too, as well.
Yeah, so that leads, I think, well into kind of the next thing that I wanted to talk about, which is exactly that sort of the periods of kind of heightened desire and lower desire that are quite common sometimes. And so one thing I think is just to acknowledge that having higher desire or lower desire is not necessarily problematic in and of itself, but it can become very problematic if it becomes distressing to the individual, if it starts to feel like it's out of control, or if it's impacting other areas of a person's life. So I guess if we start kind of mentioning sort of heightened desire, so this becomes problematic when people are violating their agreed upon relationship terms, if they're engaging in behaviors that they otherwise wouldn't want to engage in, if it's potentially leading to unintended risks, or if it's starting to impact, you know, personal or working relationships. And so I think that can be certainly very, very problematic, and the consequences of that. So it's not necessarily the desire itself, but the consequences and the choices that are unintentionally made or unwanted can lead to very problematic circumstances. And so I think one of the most important things that we can do, or that we can think about doing, is that planning ahead for when these times potentially arise. And so having a plan in place so that when certain triggers happen, or when it starts to feel like behaviors or thoughts are becoming uncontrollable, that there are sort of these if-then plans in place. And you can plan ahead to, you know, make sure that you've got condoms with you, or that you're taking safer sex practices, or that you have a backup plan, or there are people in your life who know that you can contact, and just to make sure that you're making choices that you want to be making.
Yeah. I mean, all those things, some of the things I wish I had in place. And I think part of it was I also didn't know what I was dealing with at the time. I think this was before I was diagnosed properly. And I guess the most painful part for me was when I felt that I was sort of labeling myself as promiscuous, and it was sort of violating my own values. And in hindsight, a lot of it was driven by this heightened sex drive and things that where I was acting in different ways. And it wasn't even just having sex, it was sort of being flirtatious, it was being more forward than usual, dressing provocatively. And I was also in my 20s, so I was also trying to learn sort of what was me and what wasn't me. And so there was an experimentation that was also happening. So to sort of parse apart sort of what, in hindsight anyway, what was driven by the condition, what was being driven by just an exploration of my own identity. And I think the things that I wish I had had in place were things like when I went out to nightclubs, that I had a friend who I had confided in, and that they could become sort of my backup and being able to sort of, you know, not be responsible for me, but at least be able to tap me on the shoulder. And I think also if I had known the impact of drinking, of how much that made, I mean, I was always aware that, you know, with medication, it's not a great thing, but it just heightened the whole experience. And so I think if I had known that more clearly, I might have made some different choices.
Yeah, absolutely. It can be a very challenging situation to deal with. And when we're dealing with an uncomfortable topic like sex to begin with, and then you couple that with mental health, which is uncomfortable for a lot of people to deal with as well, now we have two things that are very uncomfortable. And so absolutely, yeah, having someone that you can talk with and share that with, I think is very useful. And just to have an extra set of, you know, of eyes and,
yeah,
and support.
Yeah. Well, because I know that there was a one instance when I was at a club and I didn't want to leave, and my friends really did. And I mean, maybe I shouldn't call them friends, but anyway, they left and I ended up going home with someone who I didn't know. And it could have been a really dangerous situation. I was lucky that nothing did happen, but sort of, so, you know, choosing carefully who's around me at the same time and understanding what those triggers are. I didn't realize as myself, as an actor, where I'd be in situations where I would be, you know, doing a romantic scene. And if I was in a heightened state, I sometimes took that to the next level, thinking that it actually was happening in real life. And, oh, my acting scene partners didn't really have the same feelings as I did. So there was a lot of awkward interactions.
So I'm sure we'll come back to kind of talking about this a little bit more in heightened desire later on. But I think to couple or sort of to look at the flip side and looking at lower desire. Again, lower desire is not necessarily problematic on its own, but if it's causing personal distress and if it's causing relationship problems, then it can certainly be very challenging to deal with. And I think something just to acknowledge is that low sexual interest is the most commonly reported sexual difficulty by both men and women, and that's across the population. So it's very common. And as I said previously, low desire could absolutely be part of the bipolar disorder. It could be part of the medications that are being taken, or it could be part of other situational factors that are going on. So teasing that apart can be really difficult, and determining kind of where it's coming from can be challenging. And it certainly is not always just one thing. It can be a combination of things as well. So it can become a very complex issue. I think one thing that's important to recognize is that sex is not just sexual intercourse. So if the desire to have sexual intercourse is not there, then maybe consider exploring other behaviors or other, you know, activities with the partner, whether they're sexual or not. It could be things like holding hands or kissing, or, you know, just setting time for a date night where you put your phones away and you're actually talking with each other, so that you're prioritizing the connection and the intimacy with the partner, even if the sex itself is not necessarily happening, you know, specifically the sexual intercourse. And so having that open communication with your partner can be something that can help address what the needs of both partners are, while recognizing and respecting that there are going to be times when desire is just not quite where you would want it to be otherwise.
Yeah. And my experience with sort of low sex drive really came in partner with medication, that the side effects of medication. I think you may talk about that later, so I won't go into it too much, but that's where I had the most sort of difficulty, where I found, and with depression, the symptoms of depression.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's very common, and certainly some of the medications can be a major factor in that. But I think we'll probably touch on that again a little bit later. I think kind of the last point that I wanted to just kind of mention at this point, something going back to kind of what Emma said at the beginning, is just that it's important to talk about sex, but I think at the same time, we also have to acknowledge that it can be really uncomfortable to talk about sex. And so this can be individually, just for ourselves, it might be uncomfortable for us to think about sex and think about ourselves as sexual people. And so having an honest conversation with ourselves can be challenging. Having these open and honest conversations with our partners can be very challenging. But also having conversations with doctors and healthcare providers can be challenging as well. And so not only can it be uncomfortable for us, but the doctors and healthcare providers have very little training in med school about sexual issues. And so they may not necessarily be comfortable to talk about it as well. And that means that they may not bring it up when maybe they should, but they don't. And so sometimes if this is a, you know, something that you're dealing with, it's low desire or high desire, or just, you know, something's not feeling right, sometimes you do have to be an advocate for yourself and be willing to have these difficult conversations and bring it up with your healthcare providers in order to get the information and to seek the answers that you need.
Yeah. I was thinking about that. And I think one of the things that I found and still sometimes find is that, particularly with doctors, is not necessarily assuming that they're the authority on it. They may know obviously the medications and things, but I remember my dad talking to me about just being able to really advocate, like you were saying, Heather. And sometimes I may not get the answer that I want. So I would really encourage that if someone is having a lot of side effects, to really persist with their doctor and say, this isn't okay. Like, it doesn't have to be, you don't have to settle for a certain thing. I mean, there are trade-offs sometimes, but I still think sometimes we can give up. At least I have in the past, or I think I've seen other people sort of give up too easily. And part of that is because if you're depressed or you're dealing with a mental illness, you may not be feeling as assertive or as confident as you normally do. And so it might be helpful to, you know, have someone to advocate with you to be able to get your needs met.
Absolutely.
Thank you both for those really interesting points on this topic. I really hope that what we talk about today will help people in that process of advocating for themselves, because knowing what might occur as a result of various medications, various symptoms, and what you can actually ask for in terms of help, either from your healthcare provider, your partner, the people who can offer additional support in your life, that will hopefully empower people to have some of those challenging conversations. So it sounds like both of you might be ready to move into taking some questions. Is that right?
Sure.
Great. We have a few. We've collected some questions about sex and bipolar disorder from listeners, as well as our annual Reddit Ask Me Anything. So the first question I think I will start off with taps into something that Heather was saying earlier about some of the various causes for changes in sexual desire or performance. So do medications or mood stabilizers for bipolar disorder kill your libido? Which are the medications known for this? And what should you do if you experience sexual dysfunction as a result?
So absolutely. Some medications do have sexual side effects. It will be different for different people because the bodies will react differently. So it's certainly not the case for everyone, but there are some that are more likely to be associated with sexual dysfunctions than others. I think it's also important to note, though, that for some people, if the medications are helping mood, then that actually might be associated with less sexual difficulties. So it's really going to be very individualized. And so if you are having problems that you think might be related to some of your medications, then absolutely speaking to your doctor would be sort of the best advice. But just generally, I can speak to some of them. So some of the mood stabilizers are likely to be associated with reduced sexual desire, potentially challenges with erectile functioning, as well as reduced sexual satisfaction. So lithium, carbamazepine, and valproate are the three that are most likely to be associated. Lamotrigine somewhat less, so that could potentially be an alternative for some people. But again, that's a conversation to have with your doctor. SSRIs are kind of notoriously known for being associated with sexual dysfunction. And certainly, you know, up to even 70% of people who take SSRIs may experience some form of sexual dysfunction. But the other antidepressants can as well. For some people, these are going to be more pronounced at the beginning of starting to take this new medication. And so some of the side effects might decrease over time. However, if the side effects have been there for a prolonged period of time, then again, it might be appropriate to speak with your doctor. And possibly, potentially changing medications, but it also just might be something about revising the dose. There also might be a different combination of medications that can be taken, or the doctor might want to prescribe something like Viagra that can act in addition and treat some of the sexual side effects. So it's very individualized, but absolutely the medication can certainly be associated with reduced functioning for sure.
Yeah, and my experience was similar to having side effects. It was with lithium. It was a long time ago. My mom had been prescribed lithium because so it worked for her. So they tried it with me, and it was interesting. I don't know if it was because of the flat affect, if that goes hand in hand, but with that, it just felt like I was sort of walking around with, you know, wrapped in cotton batten or something and not really feeling much of anything. And I think one of the things that I didn't realize is that, there were other options. And so, when I did talk to my doctor, we were able to try different combinations. And then, like you said, different doses that eventually, I found something that was sort of, I got the most benefit and the most effect with the least amount of symptoms. So, and that was the part where I needed to continue to advocate, because there were times where, you know, the manias weren't happening, but the depression still were. And I thought maybe that was as good as it got. And my dad said, no, just keep on advocating and do so. Yeah. So I did. And I was lucky to find some help that way.
Yeah, I mean, I think the brain really is kind of the biggest sex organ that we have. And so anytime something is, you know, is a little bit off balance in the brain, that can affect how we experience the world sexually. And so what you're saying of having sort of, you know, that very flat affect and not even being responsive to kind of, you know, any sexual stimuli, I think that's very, very common. And I think that's, I mean, you know, kind of neurochemically that makes sense when things are off balance, and that's one of the effects that it can have.
And I think it's also, I guess, knowing what your baseline is too. So if you naturally have a low sex drive, which there's nothing wrong with that, but sort of being able to measure it in terms of that. So if there's a big change or something. And so I think that's a way of sort of recognizing whether medication is being effective or if it's impacting in a negative way.
Absolutely.
Yeah, it sounds like it can be really tricky to tease out the relative influence of, you know, low mood. And one of the classic symptoms of depression is loss of interest or enjoyment in the things that we would normally find pleasurable, as compared to, you know, these potential impacts of medication. So I think self-monitoring, knowing your baseline, like Victoria said, is really important. And we do have a previous Talk BD episode on medication, which might offer some useful strategies on how to have these conversations with your doctor, how to advocate for trialing or changing medication, if that's a route that you'd like to pursue. We've had a lot of questions come in about hypersexuality and strategies that can be employed to detect and manage this really difficult symptom. Elaborating on what you were talking about earlier, this person asks, what are the most common warning signs and behaviors of hypersexuality to look out for?
So again, this is going to vary from person to person. And I think it's often can be associated with other symptoms of elevated mood. So if you notice that, you know, some of your other warning signs to indicate that mood is starting to elevate, then that can be, you know, something to watch out for. I think kind of a preoccupation with sort of with sexual thoughts or thinking about sexual fantasies, you might start to feel that it's difficult to control the thoughts and the feelings or even kind of the urges that you have to act on the sexual behavior. So you might recognize a noticeable change in sex drive. And again, going back to what was just said, it's that you want to recognize what's different sort of as for your normal. So there's no normal for everyone. You know, there's no standard normal. Everyone has their own individual normal. And so if there's a change that's different from your own normal, then that's something to watch out for, I think.
Yeah. And my, the hypersexuality sort of warning signs went along with the typical warning signs for mania and hypomania. So I was sleeping less. I wasn't actually eating as much. I had more energy and ideas. But what also would happen was, as I mentioned before, I'd be dressing more provocatively. I'd be flirting more. I'd be more forward. I was often talking to strangers more, like doing things that I wouldn't normally do. I would be drinking more as well. And then I certainly understood, or I could relate to that sort of acting on those impulses. Sort of, it would be like an afterthought where I go, I don't know if I wanted to do that. And so that inability to sort of control the impulse or the behavior that I wanted to do. So, you know, whether that was flirting with someone that, you know, I didn't want to be flirting with, or actually having sex with someone that I, you know, didn't want to have sex with in hindsight, you know, if I hadn't been in that state. And I think the other part of the question was, ways of being able to sort of prevent it or something like that?
Yeah. So, you know, we talk a lot about noticing early warning signs of various mood changes. And so I guess, you know, elaborating on this question, once you start to notice some of these early warning signs, what's a helpful way to respond?
Do you want to go for that, Heather?
Sure. I mean, I think tying back a little bit, sort of what I said before, this idea of planning ahead, and just being mindful of what the potential triggers are, planning ahead that if you are going to be in a situation where you might be engaging in sexual behavior, that you have contraception in place, that you have condoms in place so that you can use those if you choose to, you know, having these if-then plans so that if something starts to trigger, if you start to behave in a certain way, you know what you're supposed to do, if that's to call a friend or, you know, to speak to someone about it. And then I think something else to think of as well is that, you know, thinking about different behaviors that you might want to engage in. So if the behaviors are, or the thoughts are starting to feel, you know, very overwhelming, is there sort of a lesser alternative that you might want to do? And so, you know, rather than necessarily going out or getting onto the apps and starting to match with lots of people, is there, you know, maybe you want to masturbate by yourself, and maybe that will help kind of control some of the urges, but with sort of lesser potential repercussions. So, you know, maybe if you have a regular sex partner, maybe making sure that they're available to have sex if you want to, and they're interested in having sex, or that you have other outlets that you could potentially explore that would be enjoyable for you and would help to calm some of the feelings that are being experienced.
Yeah, boy, I wish I had these ideas back then, because I feel like I went through a lot of heartache and a lot of suffering because I didn't. But one of the other things too, and I would think for myself, is being able to sort of make an agreement, whether I, you know, to not drink, or how I was going to limit my drinking, to really understand that that was a trigger for me. Sometimes, like you were saying, creating a low risk environment. So, you know, instead of maybe going out to a bar or a club, it might be having friends over or something, and having like a kitchen dance party or something, which of course isn't necessarily the equivalent, but it's sort of something in between. When I was diagnosed and this was happening, we didn't have dating apps. So I can only imagine how, like, oh my gosh, the plethora of avenues of creating havoc in your life is really hard. And so I think now I've been living well with it, so I haven't experienced the hypersexuality. But I think it'd be really interesting to find out if there's actually any sort of locks that you can put on those dating apps or something, you know, but you might have to be doing that yourself, so that you might have to do that far in advance. But
yeah, or just deleting them off the phone. If something starts, you start to feel a bit triggered, then take them off the phone until you feel that you're in a better place where you can enjoy them safely again.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, it sounds like just as individual early warning signs can be, the way that you respond to those, it involves getting creative, looking at the options that you have around you and what's the most effective and safe alternative to some of those behaviors. And I definitely appreciate what you said, Victoria, about how the landscape has changed, because I think a lot of the advice that we have available online is very much about going into nightclubs and what's a safe alternative there. But how do you manage these feelings when your phone is the way that's accessed?
Texting and all those kinds of things, those are, and the hard thing is, of course, when you're in that state, often our decision-making capabilities are compromised. So it's really about getting ahead of the train to be able to divert or do different things. And some of that, I think, comes from experience of really seeing what your warning signs are and enlisting people for support and having that. You called it a what if then plan. Is that what you called it?
If something happened, then I will do this.
Okay. Okay. Right. Okay. Yes. That sounds good. If then.
So alongside this discussion of potential early warning signs, something that we also recommend people look at when putting together their self-management plans is triggers. And this individual asks, can pornography or masturbation trigger mania? If you have a history of hypersexuality, should you avoid these triggers as much as possible? We're told that increased sexual behaviors are symptoms of mania, but in my experience, they can trigger episodes as well, much like how exercise or gambling can trigger mania for some people.
So yes, it certainly can be a trigger. It will be very different for different people. And just in general, this is an area that we really don't know very much about. And I think, you know, because there's taboo around sexuality and because there's taboo around mental health, there hasn't been the amount of research into this area that's really needed to better understand it. But that said, there is some evidence that yes, it can absolutely be a trigger for some people. And so I think that if you've identified it as a trigger for yourself, then I think that's that's an important thing. And then treating that as you would with some of your other triggers and having those plans in place of what to do when that arises.
Yeah, and I can't speak to that. It wasn't a trigger for me. So I can't really sort of give any input on it.
Thank you. I think that's important, Heather, the point that you bring up about not a lot of research being done in this area is, again, I think a symptom of that general squeamishness that we have about talking about sex, and that clearly needs to change so that we know more effective ways to detect and respond to this issue that's really important to a lot of people. Mm-hmm. We also talked about communication and the importance of that. And I'm hoping that you can give some more situationally specific advice to a couple of people. This one on the subject of really difficult conversations around hypersexuality. So this person asks, hypersexuality is no joke. I'm always worried that I may do something stupid that will destroy my relationship. What is your advice for communicating with a partner about your history of bipolar disorder and hypersexuality?
Yeah, so absolutely. When you're dealing with two very difficult topics to begin with, then there's going to be a lot of emotion and a lot of challenges that we face in having these difficult conversations, because it's doubly difficult. And so I think recognizing that it is a very complex issue, I think, is important. And I think recognizing that it's an ongoing issue as well. So this isn't just a singular conversation, but it's something that's going to need to be talked about, several times ongoing throughout the relationship, and having an open conversation about it that continues, I think, is really important. And I think one of the good things, though, so one of the benefits of having these difficult conversations is that we know that there is lots of research that shows that when partners can have these challenging conversations and when they can talk about sex, it actually leads to greater closeness and intimacy in the relationship. So even though it's challenging, there are benefits that come from it. In addition to sort of addressing the issue that needs to be talked about, there are these extra benefits of building the bond and increasing the intimacy. So I think recognizing that it's kind of it's a challenging conversation, it's a high stakes conversation, recognizing that it's sensitive and that it's personal, and recognizing that we are probably going to want to have a sense that we want to avoid it, but being able to kind of face that can be positive. And so I think in terms of actual sort of strategies, I think recognizing where you're coming from. So what are your beliefs around sex and around mental health? What are your experiences with that? But recognizing what your partner's beliefs and experiences are as well, or asking them about that, just so that you understand where you're both coming from. I think one thing that's really important is to recognize what your expectations are. When we have difficult conversations, oftentimes we're feeling very insecure. It's, we're afraid of making ourselves vulnerable. We're afraid of being embarrassed, and we feel shame, or we're afraid of being rejected. And so when we're coming into a conversation with all of those negative feelings, oftentimes we'll set ourselves up for defeat in a way, because we're worried that our partner is going to react negatively. And so we create sort of this, self-fulfilling prophecy in a way, where we go in kind of hesitant and scared. And so then our partner reacts hesitant and scared, and it just cycles from that. So if we can think about and sort of plan ahead of how we want to approach it, we can think about the words that we want to use, the tone that we want to have. And if we can go into the conversation, hoping for positive outcomes, then I think that can set us up for success. And one thing that I think people don't necessarily often recognize is that our partners are often much more open and much more willing to have these conversations than we might realize or that we might recognize. And so they don't necessarily have to be, you know, bad conversations. They'll be challenging, but they don't necessarily have to be negative. And so give your partner the benefit of the doubt, assume that they're going to react positively to this, and go in with that open mind to have an open and honest conversation. I think one thing to do as well is just acknowledge that discomfort right off the bat. Acknowledge that you feel uncomfortable. Acknowledge that this might be difficult for your partner. Acknowledge that you feel embarrassed. Allow yourself to have that level of vulnerability. And I think planning ahead, as I said, and that actually might mean setting aside a time when you're both available. It's not a heated moment. It's not right after you've had sex. It's a time where emotions are more calm. And it's a time where you can plan and you can even just say, look, we need to have a conversation about something. It might be a bit difficult, but can we do this on this night at this time? Turn off your phones, turn off the TV, just sit down and have that conversation. And if you need to treat it like a business meeting, then even kind of make some points on a, you know, on a piece of paper, have an agenda. These are the things that I want to talk about. Try and take the emotion out of it as much as possible, because it will be a heated, or won't be a heated conversation, but it'll be an emotional conversation. And just recognizing that ahead of time, and that's not a bad thing, but acknowledging that can be the case. And so having these strategies in place to minimize some of the negative feelings that you might be having.
Yeah, I can relate to sort of the poor experiences that I've had trying to have conversations about sex, and it, because of my own discomfort. And I really relate to sort of, you know, going in scared and hesitant, and it creates sort of this negative feedback loop almost. And the only thing that I found is that when I did try to say, well, let's set up a time to talk, then he would be worried about what it was that we were going to talk about. So I'd be really interested in finding out how you sort of troubleshoot that. Cause that was the only thing, is that, you know, I thought, okay, I'll do that and say, could we sit down tonight? And then it's like, well, what do you mean? Why don't we do it right now? And then it got, you know, even more challenging. And I think one of the other things that I found too, when I was in relationship was, you know, when was I going to tell people or the partner about bipolar disorder? And then on top of that, talk about the hypersexuality. And I think one of the benefits that I had later on was when I had a more stable relationship, I was more stable in my own conditions. So I wasn't in that same really huge ups and downs. So it didn't actually impede as much. And I think that was one good thing, is that, you know, I was learning to self-manage a lot of the symptoms, and that really benefited. It didn't mean that I didn't talk to my partners about it, but it just meant that the impact could be less. But I don't know, do you have any thoughts on that? Sort of, if you say that you want to have a conversation, it might be difficult, and then the other person goes, but what is it going to be about? Let's do it now then, or whatever.
Yeah. So the first time that you're having the conversation, for sure, that can be very challenging. I mean, I think give as much information as you can, that, you know, setting up the topic, just saying, I need to talk to you about, you know, something that might be a little uncomfortable. It's to do with sex. I'd like to be able to have this conversation in a way that's, you know, comfortable and supportive for us. Are you open to that? And then, so if they're open to that, okay, when would be a good time for us to have the conversation? And then if they say, well, I'd like to have that conversation right now, then you could say, okay, I'm not quite ready to have that conversation right now. I could be ready in an hour to have that conversation, or I could be ready tomorrow to have that conversation. Would that be okay?
That's good.
So let them schedule it maybe that way, but make sure that it's still comfortable with what works for you. But you know, don't keep them in the dark completely. Let them
I know. I know. Yeah. Yeah. I think that was my mistake, right?
I have something awful to tell you. I'm not going to tell you what it is.
Yeah. It's really bad. It's about the relationship.
Don't do it that way.
Yeah, don't do it that way. That's right. That's a good strategic, you know, and no.
I think that's really great advice about how to approach these conversations, knowing that, you know, as you said, Heather, really early on, and I think Victoria as well, many of us have never actually practiced having these conversations. We've grown up with a lot of secrecy around this subject. So then how do you start having the conversation about something that's so intimate and personal, and because of that, very vulnerable and emotional in a really healthy way? So I think that's really solid ground to start from. And as the person who would be, what conversation? What are we going to talk about? Why can't we have it now? I really appreciate that.
Yeah.
You've elaborated on how you might approach that for maybe the more anxious people in the room.
And I also really appreciate being like giving an example of how I can also set a boundary too. So, because normally if they want to talk about it now, it'd be okay. And inside I'm going, oh my God, I'm so not ready. I don't know. I don't have my notes. Where's my notes? And so, yeah. So I really like that. I think it's really helpful. It's helpful for any kind of uncomfortable conversation, but particularly this one.
Yeah. And I think that's important, is that you want to make the situation as comfortable as possible. And so that's not only for yourself, but for your partner as well. And so giving them, you know, as much information as you can about what the conversation is going to be about, letting them know that you feel anxious about having the conversation is important, because then that's going to hopefully make them more receptive. And if they think, you know, they might not understand that you're anxious about it, they might assume that it's something bad, when it's not necessarily something bad at all. It's just something difficult to talk about. And so even saying it's not something bad, it's not something, you know, that's necessarily to be worried about. It's just something that I want to talk to you about. And let's, you know, approach this together to make sure that we're, you know, having the best relationship that we can.
And one of the things that I have found in uncomfortable conversations and sexual conversations is really being clear about what I want to talk about and the points that I would like to make, because I know that I'll be emotional. I usually am going to be really nervous. The other person, you know, may be nervous, or I don't know what they may have a different perspective of what I'm saying. And so I need to be really clear so that I don't sort of doubt myself about what I am trying to communicate. And that has really helped. It's difficult, but it's something that's sort of made me feel more confident going in. If I just have one thing, right? One thing at a time. Don't try to do the whole, you know, I was going to say, don't try to cover the whole Kama Sutra, just part of it, just one little thing.
Yeah, I was actually going to make that exact same point, is that there can, as I said, this is an ongoing conversation, or this should be an ongoing conversation. And so it's not just one. And hopefully it will get easier the more you chat with your partner and the more that, you know, you talk with them. But that first time you want to have that conversation, limit it to one key piece of information that you want to share or that you want to discuss. And then if there is something else, then plan to have the next conversation and then another conversation after that. It does not have to be, you know, a marathon, you know, 4-hour session or conversation. Yeah. It can be a short, you know, snippet, and then you come back to it and come back to it and come back to it.
Yeah.
Thank you. I'm conscious that we haven't asked many questions on lower desire or hypersexuality. And I know a couple have come up about kind of similar questions about how would you talk with a partner about this topic. Is there anything additional that you would suggest having that people keep in mind if they were having a conversation about ways as a couple to manage those periods of low desire?
Yeah. So actually this would apply both for periods of hypersexuality as well as periods of lower sexuality, but also if it's difficult to have that conversation with your partner directly, it may be appropriate to have a like kind of a joint counseling session, or if you have a therapist that you're already speaking with and you would feel comfortable having your partner come into that session with you, then that can be an opportunity to discuss some of the issues as well. So that applies, I think, for both. But coming back to the idea of sort of lowered desire, I think recognizing that, recognizing how your partners are feeling, I think, can be quite important as well. And so your partners may be feeling rejected, even if they know that the cause is because of the bipolar symptoms that you're experiencing. But I think having that communication and, you know, providing some reassurance that it's not a rejection of them, it's just because of these other factors that are happening, I think that can help. I think having that communication can really, just having the communication in general can help to build the emotional intimacy and the connection, and being able to have those difficult conversations can actually benefit the relationship, as I was saying. I think one thing to think about as well is that a lot of times people assume that desire has to happen before sexual behavior. And that's what we would call sort of spontaneous desire. And that's what we see in the movies and the media. And that's what's sold to us as being kind of this ideal that we all want to have this, you know, crazy sex life where we're just having lots of fun sort of all the time. And I think in reality, that's not necessarily how it happens. Not that we're, you know, not enjoying our sex lives, but spontaneous desire doesn't necessarily happen for everyone all the time, especially once people are in long-term relationships. What's actually much more common is what's called responsive desire. And for responsive desire, what happens is that the sexual kind of behavior actually starts, and then the sort of the psychological desire and the physical desire kicks in afterwards. So I want to be really clear, of course, if you're not interested in having sex, then you absolutely never should have sex if you're not wanting to do that. But if you're in a more neutral place, or you're somewhat open to the idea of having sex, but just the desire is what's lacking, starting the sexual encounter, kissing with your partner, that can actually trigger some of those feelings of desire. And of course, if they don't, and if you want to stop the encounter, then that is, of course, absolutely what you should do. But just maybe starting it out and seeing if that can actually lead to something a little bit more and have that trigger that responsive desire rather than just expecting it to be the spontaneous desire all the time. And I think maybe coming back to this idea as well, what I said before is that sex is not just intercourse. And so if you don't want to have, you know, kind of penetrative sex, then that's absolutely fine. Are there other behaviors that you might want to engage in? Would you want to experience mutual masturbation with your partner, where you're both touching yourselves and you're creating a sexual environment, but you're not touching each other? Or would you want to have like a massage? Is that something that would feel comfortable? Or even just going for a walk together and holding hands, or as I said, turning off the TV, turning off the phones, and just having a conversation with each other. So I think focusing on the intimacy and the connection separate from the sex can also help to build and increase the sexual desire and the sexual intimacy as well.
Yeah, I know that I can say that a lot of it had to do for me continuing to build trust in that intimacy in general. And I think that would be the case whether you have bipolar disorder or not. And just continuing to build that sort of affection that goes along with a long-term relationship, particularly in long-term relationships, because I think, you know, the desire can start to wane, and then it can get very easily just sort of pushed to the side. And I think it's important, as long as we're continuing to sort of build that connection and intimacy, then it becomes that's the avenue to inward, so to speak.
And I think something that other people, you know, might not be aware of is that, again, because we're sort of, you know, given this stereotype of, you know, all this passion that supposedly is happening to everyone else but us, there's been studies that have looked at reasons why people actually do have sex. And believe it or not, there was 237 different reasons why people were motivated to have sex. And only a small portion of them were due to that spontaneous desire or that sort of overwhelming horniness that we have. A lot of them were due to building the intimacy, to having that connection with the partner. And so I think if we're open and we're willing to step outside of maybe sort of what we've been used to and explore having sex for other reasons, then that can also help to kind of then lead into that sort of responsive desire, as I was saying before.
I really appreciate, Heather, that you kind of mentioned the way movies set us up with different expectations and a very, you know, specific sexual script about what happens and when, and you know, it's very heteronormative. It doesn't encompass the majority of people's experiences, like that spectrum of 237 reasons. And only two of those are showing up in movies and the rest we just don't talk about. So I really appreciate the illumination that you're bringing to this topic.
Thank you.
The next question is a little bit heavy, but I think it's a really important one to bring up when we are talking about how sex and desire might change for people living with bipolar disorder. So this person asks, how do I come to terms with things I did when manic and hypersexual? I don't act like myself at all. Afterwards, I feel so guilty and embarrassed, and it just makes my depression so much worse.
Yeah. So I think acknowledging it, I think, is really important, and recognizing the feelings that you are experiencing, and then just trying to have as much self-kindness and self-compassion as possible. And thinking about sort of if your best friend was coming to you and telling you this story, you know, how would you respond to them? What kindness would you show your best friend? And then trying to show yourself that kindness as well. And then I think absolutely speaking with a, you know, therapist or a counselor that you have an established relationship with, or that you feel comfortable at least speaking with, I think can help to work through some of that as well.
Yeah, and I can very much relate to the question. I think that was probably the most difficult part. It's one of the most difficult parts of bipolar disorder to sort of come to terms with. Acting so out of character. And so, like you suggested, Heather, really trying to treat myself with as much kindness as possible, or listen to the people who are around me who care about me, and try to take that in. And I think one of the most important things was also to really learn to separate the behavior from who I was, because I sort of thought if I was acting in this way, regardless, you know, it said something about me and my inability to, you know, control myself and all this, as instead of recognizing that my behavior was driven by this condition, and then being able to sort of, for me, talking to a counselor, and I think also, I don't know if grieving is the right word, but being able to talk about it really openly and how sad I was, right? How sad it affected me, how other people perceived me, who I didn't have a chance to explain how I was, why it was happening. And I was able to come to a place where I was able to sort of forge a new identity that included my past, but didn't punish me for it. And I was able to sort of see the difference between myself and my behavior. And with that, it was easier to give myself sort of compassion. And it just then built upon that. And being able to confide in a close friend was really important for me too. And I think also at times, I mean, it's not spoken that much about in support groups, but I found in general going to a support group made me aware that I really wasn't alone in a lot of these different kinds of behaviors and experiences, and understanding that it was part of the, it could be part of the pattern for some people, which was including for myself.
Thank you so much for your openness and vulnerability, Victoria, and sharing that. And I think it's, you know, it is a really difficult topic, but I think it will be hopeful to many people to hear that that process of forging a new identity and looking back without punishing yourself is, mm-hmm. is possible, especially in a culture that places so much shame and stigma and moralistic attitudes around how and who we have sex with, especially for women and for people who aren't cis or heterosexual. I think it's really important to talk about that way forward is possible. I think we have time for one final question, and this one kind of relates to the topic of hypervigilance and, you know, knowing what that threshold is between normal and something to be concerned about, which is something that a lot of people with bipolar disorder tell us they grapple with. So this person asks, I have bipolar disorder type 2, and I've only ever experienced mild hypomania. When I have an increased sex drive, it's enjoyable for my partner and myself. I've never done anything risky. Is there any reason not to just enjoy this change while it lasts? It's a welcome break from how I feel about sex when depressed.
So I'd say absolutely enjoy it. So many people do perceive increased sexual interest, increased sexual desire as being positive, and that's a great thing. And if it's working for you, then that's good, and enjoy it while it lasts. And, you know, as I said at the very beginning, it's not necessarily the increased or the decreased kind of interest and desire that's problematic. It's when it starts to negatively impact things like your day-to-day functioning, if it's causing distress or if it's impacting other areas of your life, such as your work or your relationships. But if it's not causing any problems, then just enjoy it.
Yeah. And I think the as a person who's some sort of experienced in a certain way, is still have those plans, those sort of the what did you call it? The when if then when if then. Okay, I'll get it eventually.
If something happens, then I will.
Then, because you, the person asking the question said they hadn't done anything risky, which is wonderful. It'd be great to have something in place in case. And and then I think you can enjoy it without feeling worried about, oh, okay, is this going to do something or something like that? And so, yeah, I think, and like Heather, you had mentioned that people without bipolar disorder, their sexual drive ebbs and flows as well. So a person who doesn't have bipolar disorder, if they have a heightened sex drive, you know, ideally, they'll be able to enjoy it. And then when it, you know, ebbs the other way, then, you know, it changes behavior as well. So yeah. Go, woohoo!
Yes, I think, you know, just like packing an umbrella for a rainy day, Victoria, your point about making plans just in case is well taken.
Yeah, and then you can really sort of surrender and enjoy it. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. As always, I think we wish we had more time for questions, but we have collected some additional helpful resources that you can find on the talkbd.live episode page. But to conclude, I wanted to thank both our speakers for their time and expertise and vulnerability talking about this topic today. The message that really stuck out to me is that being open is so vital to healthy sexuality, and I really do hope and believe that this episode has done a lot of good for shedding light on this important yet sometimes neglected or stigmatized topic. And I also appreciate that being reminded that normal sexuality looks different to everyone else can make it easier to approach some of those difficult conversations. And it also hopefully will make it easier to be kind to oneself, which as always is a key message that winds through our Talk BD episodes. So thank you again to Heather and Victoria. Thank you to everyone who is listening and watching. We hope you found today's talk informative and helpful. And until next time, please do take care. Bye.